Yes, 14 past 8, you're listening to Sabahul Muslim on Radio Islam International. It's time for the Big Picture program with A.B. Dawji, live from KwaZulu-Natal. We do have Uncle A.B. with us on the line. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
How are you keeping this morning, Uncle A.B.?
Things in Durban are always wonderful, alhamdulillah.
Were you affected by the storms recently?
Yes, I was swimming around in my house here in Isipingo. This was, the center of all the deluge, and water was pouring into the house. But alhamdulillah, we just took it all out and everything is back to normal.
Alhamdulillah, may Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala make it easy for
Ameen.
You.
Ameen.
Gee, the story that caught your eye this week.
You know, I'm always intrigued by the whole question of caste. Or about, they say, which gam are you from? And that will determine whether you are upper class or middle class or lower class, depending on a particular viewpoint, a person's perspective, and also what language you speak. You know, in the old days, Sheikh, maybe not too long ago, it was a very big thing. A boy wants to marry a girl. No, cannot happen. Can't allow it. He is Sudri or Kanam or Cockney or she is Memon or Urdu speaking and so on. The mother clutches her chest like she's about to have a heart attack and father says, see, you want to kill your mother, eh? Stop your nonsense. Then girls get educated. Well, they got educated and they got professions and they went out into the world and they got jobs and so on. And parents began to wonder very nervously who she will meet. And so she announced that Imran's family is coming with Mangu. Proposal. And of course they are relieved. He is a nice Muslim boy. Never mind that he's a Memon or Sulti or Urdu speaking, whether he's a Khan or a Sidat. It's great news. And just by the way, today's young people don't even speak any of the Indian languages, Urdu or Gujarati or Memon or anything. Zero, not a word. Yet you still hear someone saying he or she is Urdu speaking. Anyway, back to the subject. What a relief, eh? What a relief. He's a nice Muslim boy from the Qadi family or the Khatri family. No, we don't believe in all these caste things and all. Nearby or Kolvad. What's the difference? We're all Muslim there. So that was the shift now. That's the shift. Then the big one. Imran says, Ma, the girl at work, very decent person, very decent. She wants to convert to Islam. And, I like her very, very much and want to marry her. The family, the Christians, a very decent family. Now that's a big one. They are Christians, and she wants to be Muslims. So, chalo, bismillah, what to do, eh? What to do? She's becoming Muslim. And that's where it stops, my dear brother. That's where it stops. Because the biggest fear these days is that Imran will come home one day and announce, Ma, this is Junaid. We're getting married. Instant heart attack, eh? Kiran Alugos. Or maybe I'm adding extra masala to this issue of caste, but for many it's a reality. And so all this brings me to the issue of the caste system in India. You know, in many places it's still a very, very rigid system. The discrimination is very strong. The Dalits are regarded as being very low caste. I came across an article in the British Telegraph newspaper yesterday. In India's western Gujarat state, a young Dalit man was stabbed. And there are other Dalits also who were beaten up by the Rajputs. The Rajputs, these are regarded as upper class, the Rajputs, a superior caste. So what did these young Dalits, these Dalit fellows do? What did they do that was so wrong? What was their crime? Did they try their luck with the Rajput girl? What was it that angered the Rajput fellows, eh? And the answer is the Rajput fellows objected to the Dalit guys having mustaches.
Wow.
Yes, I'm not kidding. The Rajputs believe that only they, the upper caste, should have mustaches. Let me read from the Telegraph newspaper. It says here, Krunal Maheria, one of the teenage victims, told NDTV news channel, one of the attackers told me that I cannot become a Rajput by just growing a mustache. When I ignored him, he beat me with a stick. Piyush Parmar, 24-year-old, claimed he and a cousin were followed and set upon by men in his village, which is Limborda, because of his facial hair. Well, you know,
wow.
There's been something of a backlash, actually. When the story came out about the Dalit youngsters being beaten by the Rajputs because they kept mustaches, Dalits from all over the country went onto social media. And let me read a little bit more. The defiant online campaign that followed features the word Mr. Dalit topped by a crown and a grand mustache. This in turn prompted hundreds of other Dalits to tweet pictures of their mustaches using the hashtag Mr. Dalit and Dalit with mustache. The Times of India declared yesterday, if the attackers were trying to repress the Dalits, they achieved just the opposite by making the upturned mustache the symbol of their defiance. Sure, can you believe it, eh? And we here in South Africa think we have problems. In India, there's a big mustache war carrying on. And it's all very hair-raising, isn't it? Okay, now to the next story, and it concerns the big Cold War between the Saudis and the UAE, ganging up on Qatar. Sanctions have been imposed on Qatar and will only be lifted until and unless three main demands are met.
Right.
Qatar must cut off its relations with Iran. It must shut down Al Jazeera. And thirdly, it must comply and fall in line with the policies of Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Khalas, that's it. Nothing more. No compromise. No giving in. These are the three demands, finish and klar, and they have been in place since June the 2nd. But you know what? Suddenly, this week, it all changed. There was now just one demand. What is it, eh? Shut down Al Jazeera? No. Iran? No. What was the one big demand? That if Qatar agreed to it, then the blockade will be lifted. And the answer is, Qatar must give up hosting the 2022 Football World Cup. You heard right. On Sunday, the Deputy Chief of Police and Public Security in Dubai, his name is Dahi Khalfan, he tweeted, if the World Cup leaves Qatar, Qatar's crisis will be over. You know what, Maulana?
Yeah.
I give up with this lot. Eh? People are dying like flies in Yemen. The Rohingyas are crying out in desperation. And these clowns are blockading Qatar because of soccer. Eh? It's just so outrageously silly. Ullus of the first order. And speaking about Ullus, here's a story from this morning's newspaper. I keep you up to date, right?
See.
It says here, more news from America. A man walked into a Louisiana Circle K, which is a supermarket. Then he put a $20 bill on the counter and asked for change. When the clerk opened the cash drawer, the man pulled a gun and demanded all the cash in the register, which the clerk promptly provided. The man took the cash from the clerk and fled, leaving the $20 bill on the counter. The total amount of cash he got from the drawer was $15. I think it goes without saying that this failed robber is the Mamparo of the week.
Yeah, it's quite interesting there. Now, moving on to another issue, the unity agreement between the two Palestinian sides that's taking place right now.
Maulana, before I get to what's happening there, let me first address a question that poses something of a dilemma, a quandary. What do you do when you are faced with an enemy who is opposing you and who is 100 times or maybe 1,000 times more powerful than you are in terms of military power? Do you use violence to resist this oppression? And what would be the consequences if you do? Well, I think it's very clear. Your adversary, your enemy will smash you. And that's quite obvious. But secondly, your enemy will use your violent resistance as the reason why you need to be smashed. The focus is on your violent actions, not on your grievances, not the oppression that you are suffering. For example, the Burmese army is very, very strong. The Rohingya people are being ethnically cleansed. Hey, I saw something very terrible this morning on Al Jazeera, where a lady, it was very harrowing and heart-stopping, where a lady, a mother, is describing how her baby was taken by the soldiers and thrown into the fire right in front of her. Ah, I can just imagine the heartbreak there. Anyway, so a very tiny number of Rohingyas decided, you know, we can't take this anymore. We have to fight back. And so they attacked the army post or the police headquarters. It was a very small, very small-scale attack. They hardly have any weapons.
Yeah.
But the Burmese government says, see, you see, this is the reason why our army is carrying out raids on the Rohingyas. We are fighting terrorism. That is what they have been saying to the world, and that's what Aung San Suu Kyi has been telling the world also. Let's take Hamas as the next example. It is regarded as a resistance movement. Resistance against what? Well, against Israel's oppression, land confiscations, house demolitions, arbitrary arrest, and detention without trial, and torture, and humiliation, and deaths, and so on. You know the whole story, right? So Hamas uses violence to resist. It fires some homemade rockets at Israel that have very little potential to damage. And Israel reportedly has the fourth strongest army in the world. It's got tanks and fighter jets and helicopter gunships and troops with very, very powerful weapons. So you saw what happened in Gaza not long ago. Total devastation. And what did Israel tell the world? What would you do if 8,000 rockets were fired at you, were raining down on you? Wouldn't you also respond in the same way? There's no mention that the 8,000 rockets do not have the same destructive powers of just one single fighter jet. Just one. No mention, of course, that the Palestinian people have genuine grievances or that the situation in Gaza is desperate and that the blockade is a crime against humanity. No, nothing of that is mentioned. The word is Hamas is a terrorist organization and has to be smashed. And that's what has been done, to the effect that Hamas knows that it is now foolhardy, well, for some time now, that it's foolhardy itself, destructive to fight against the oppression by violent means, and has for many, many years now been trying to stop militant groups from firing rockets. Just a few days ago, a rocket was fired by an unknown group in the Gaza, and Israeli jets immediately blasted what they call Hamas targets. So, under these circumstances, resistance is hopeless and only attracts bombs falling on your head. So the big question is, what to do? Do you resist oppression by violent means when your enemy is infinitely more powerful than you are and also controls the discourse, calls you a terrorist? Or do you use non-violent means, passive resistance, the Gandhian model under these circumstances, and thereby appeal to the world's moral conscience? And so you take away the excuse of the oppressor that you are a terrorist, and so the focus will be purely and solely on the oppression that you are suffering. Do you get, I'm addressing the listeners now, I hope you get my point. And are you still with me? It's an open question and there are no easy answers. Should the Rohingyas, the tiny group of militants, have attacked the military because, as they said, we can't just sit around and do nothing while our people are being brutalized so viciously? I think it's a great topic of discussion over Dalgos today. Just when the Bali has his mouth full of aloo fry, dear ladies, ask the question. I wonder if the Rohingya resistance against the Burmese army is counterproductive. Sure. That should make him very cross-eyed immediately. And now to another important issue. The coming together of Fatah and Hamas.
Yeah.
The ending of the discord. Before I go further, let me say this. On this program, I express my views about various issues. It's my perspective.
See.
It's the way I see it. And of course, you may disagree with me, and that's fine. No problem whatsoever. But please, please, listen carefully to what I say. Don't hear what I didn't say. Don't hear what I didn't say. Some have the tendency to listen with one ear.
Gee.
One ear. And then they misinterpret and jump to conclusion, and then they label you and so on. I like to quote the example repeatedly when everybody was celebrating in 2006 when Hamas was won the Palestinian elections. I said in an article I wrote that was published in Jordan and which I read out on this program, in which I strongly criticized Hamas for taking part in a Bantu-style type of elections that would get it nowhere. In fact, the title of the article was The Downside to the Landslide, meaning that Hamas had won the election by a landslide, but the consequences of taking part in the elections would be very negative. So my point is that, or was at that time, that Hamas should not compromise but stick to resistance in the way that the ANC did. No compromise. So I was in effect taking a hardline approach against Israel. But the one-ear character said, I am attacking Hamas and therefore I am pro-Israel because I'm taking tours there. How silly can you get? And so, dear listeners, sometimes the truth, no matter how unpalatable, no matter how difficult to swallow, has to be told.
Correct.
And what I am about to say may be distressing, disconcerting to some. But you know what? That is sometimes the effect of facing the truth. That's what happens. Sometimes it can distress you. So this is what I have to say. Hamas has been defeated. It's over. The end. Don't get me wrong. Hamas members and leaders are good people, have always been. Rantisi,
yes.
Sheikh Yassin, all committed to work for the good of the Palestinian people. Honest and sincere people. But Hamas has been systematically throttled. Hamas took over Gaza in 2007 and since then have been put under siege, first by Israel, then Egypt, and finally quite incredibly, by Palestinians themselves, that is Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. And let's not forget that Saudi Arabia and the Gulf State declared that Hamas is a terrorist organization. So, Israel put in place the blockade, which caused great suffering. Egypt closed the Rafah crossing and bulldozed the tunnels, which were a lifeline for Gaza. And then the wretched Abbas told Israel to cut off the electricity to Gaza, allowing only 3 to 4 hours of electricity per day. And he cut off the salaries of about 40,000 civil servants, teachers, doctors, municipal workers, etc., in the Gaza Strip. No electricity means no way to clean water, to filter the water. And of course, this equals to sickness for the people. No way to treat the sewage, which then just flowed into the sea. Raw sewage contaminated the Gaza coast. People stopped swimming. Why did Mahmoud Abbas and his thugs want to choke Gaza? So that in their desperation, the people would then turn against Hamas. And the people of Gaza are in the worst state that they've ever been, suffering on a scale like never before. The aim of Mahmoud Abbas was to force Hamas to throw in the towel, give up control of Gaza, and hand it back to the government in the West Bank. Just to be clear, there are two governments of the Palestinian people, Gaza under Hamas and the West Bank, about 7 or 8 little towns under Mahmoud Abbas's Palestinian Authority. And of course, as I always say, it's also got a toy parliament there in Ramallah. And so this week, we see the end of Hamas. It had no choice. Let me repeat that. It had no choice but to throw in the towel. It just could not continue to watch helplessly as the suffering of its people in Gaza grew worse by the day, and it could do absolutely nothing about it. Hamas faced the two possibilities to get out of this situation. The first was provided by that arch villain, Mohammed Dahlan. I spoke about him last week.
Yeah.
Hamas kicked him out of Gaza in 2007 after Hamas won the elections because he tried to stage a coup and take over Gaza. He was then a big shot in the West Bank Palestinian government of Abbas, a first-class thug. And recently, as I told you, he came with an offer, put this on the plate, let me take control of Gaza and I will bring millions of dollars from the UAE. Well, Hamas met him in Cairo just a few weeks ago. But Mahmoud Abbas made a strong bid also. Let us, the government in the West Bank, take control of Gaza and we will improve the lives of the people. Well, in the end, Hamas decided that Dahlan option will not solve anything, and so they decided to let Mahmoud Abbas take control, and that is what was agreed to yesterday. Hamas signed, and I'm going to put it very harshly, its death warrant. It's over, dear people. And the people in Gaza, of course, they celebrated. Why? Why were they happy? Because life will be better, much better. Electricity, water, goods coming in, the economy will improve, and so on. And let me say this. It's good that the two sides of the Palestinian people are now friends, brothers again, not enemies any longer. But that's where it stops. This unity does not have any impact on Israel at all. In fact, Israel is very quiet. And if Israel is quiet, then it means that it is satisfied with the outcome, with the developments, this unity thing. Mahmoud Abbas and his Palestinian Authority are, of course, sellouts, something I've said often. They work closely with Israel. And now Mahmoud Abbas has co-opted Hamas, gobbled it all up, compromised it, defeated it. What a victory as far as Israel is concerned. And nothing changes. Do not think at all that this unity agreement between Hamas and Mahmoud Abbas's Fatah is in some way a united front to oppose Israel's oppression of the Palestinian people. That it would force Israel to the so-called negotiating table and the result would be a two-state solution. Forget it. Forget it. Israel feels not the slightest pressure or threat from the uniting of the two sides of the Palestinian people. Not one ounce of it. It just wants Abbas to rule over Gaza and parts of the West Bank and keep everything nice and quiet. Nice and quiet. Don't even bring up the subject of peace talks to hand over land because Netanyahu still holds that some card. Well, Abbas, you joined with Hamas, that's fine, but if you want to negotiate about the two-state solution, then Hamas, your partner, has to do three things. Number one, recognize Israel. Number two, give up its weapons. And number three, accept the deal, the Oslo agreement that Arafat signed in 1993. Of course, Hamas cannot do this. So, no peace talks and no giving back of land. And so Israel will merrily continue building settlements in the West Bank. Netanyahu actually said this yesterday, that the unity agreement, in his words, makes peace much harder to achieve. Shame, eh? He was always wanting to make peace with the Palestinians and give them their own state in which they could live happily ever after. Eh? And all this reminds me of an English expression. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I never really knew what that meant. So I just checked it up. And Maulana, this is what I got. Turbulent changes do not affect reality on a deeper level other than to cement the status quo. Shoo, that's a mouthful, eh? But it puts it also clearly in explaining what's happening in the world of the Palestinians. And let me end by saying that I'm quite surprised when I read an article by British Palestinian academic and political activist Azam Tamimi. He is a strong and outspoken supporter of Hamas, always has been, and I was quite taken aback by what he said. Let me quickly read an extract. He says, there is no doubt that the siege imposed on Gaza by Israel and Egypt has achieved its objective. Life has become unbearable, that public opinion within the strip, within the Gaza Strip, is overwhelming in favor of any deal that is said to promise easing the pressure. This has prompted Hamas to express readiness to make concessions that had until recently been inconceivable. Wow, eh? Inconceivable, Maulana, is the right word. Throwing in the towel would even be more accurate, you know? And I have never heard Azam Tamimi being so disillusioned and so pessimistic. Well, just as in 2007, people in Gaza were celebrating that Hamas had won the Palestinian elections, and at that time I was quite sad, so also, while I'm happy that the people of Gaza will see some improvement in their terrible lives, I am at the same time sad that the era of Hamas is over. Well, that's all I have to say, and I pray very hard that my comments were heard with both ears, inshallah. Mm.
Yes, there is Ruchi. Jazakallah for that insight, Uncle Abi. Now the light at the end of the tunnel.
Maulana, Ronnie from Nearbank, he's back in ICU. Back in ICU. Let me tell you what happened.
See.
Ronnie came home and told his wife, Pushpa, darling, I invited Kenny, my boss, to come for supper and all.
Right.
He will be here in half an hour. And Pushpa said, what? Are you mad? The house is in a mess. I didn't go shopping to buy meat and veg, and all the dirty dishes are still on the dining room table, and the sink is full of dirty pots, and I don't like cooking a fancy meal today. Ronnie replied, I know that, Pushpa. And Pushpa said, so why did you invite him for supper and all? And Ronnie replied, because the silly fool is thinking about getting married. Okay, one last one. Quick one, yeah? General Gumede is the head of the South African Navy. He was visiting the Army headquarters in Durban, and he was greeted by General Marimutu of the South African military. General Gumede asked Marimutu, how are your men? And Marimutu says, very well, eh? Very well, Saints. Eh? And Gumede says, I hope so. You see, my men in the Navy are also well trained, and they are the bravest in the whole country. And Mari says, yes, my men are also very brave and all. And Gumede says, I would like to see that. And Marimutu shouts out, Private Sipo, come here. You see that tank coming here? I want you to stand in front and stop it with your body. And Private Sipo answers, aye, boy, hey, Putsang, are you crazy? You want me to be killed? Hey, you mampara, I am gone from here. And saying that, he runs away. And Marimutu, sweating a little bit, turns to Gumede and says, you see, you have to be very brave to talk like that to a general. That's all for today, sir.
JazakAllah for your time, Uncle Ibi. May Allah reward you, and we hope to speak to you again soon, inshallah.
Inshallah. JazakAllah khair.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.